It's fake.
Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to understand the stories that shape politics and policies in the United States. To do that, we sit down each week with journalists, scholars, filmmakers, and more to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To help us this week, we're joined by Alan Lightman, a physicist, humanist, and author of the critically acclaimed Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. Alan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim.
So congratulations on the new book. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about that today. But let's start with you and where you're from. Are you originally from Memphis?
I'm from Memphis, Tennessee.
Born and raised?
Elvis land, born and raised. I left at age 17 to go to college. Then I went to graduate school on the West Coast and came back to the East Coast to work and do research and write.
So you have sort of an interesting academic existence because you're both a physicist, but you're also a person of letters. Mm-hmm. Is that duality, has that been part of you since childhood?
That's been part of me since childhood. Okay. I had two groups of friends, the science types and the art crowd. And
but earlier in your career and in school, you really focused on the sciences.
Well, when I got to college, I focused on the sciences, but I was writing poetry and short stories at the time. But I got my formal education in science.
Why?
Well, because scientists do their best work when they're younger. And I know of some scientists who later became writers, but I don't know of any writers who later became scientists.
That's interesting.
That's a really good point. So we'll fast forward. You got a doctoral degree from Caltech in theoretical physics, and you received the first dual faculty appointment in science and the humanities at MIT. Tell us about that. I mean, why did they create that position? Was it specifically for you?
Well, MIT is a very flexible place. The lines between disciplines are not so sharp at MIT. There's a lot of interdisciplinary work, and so they might have created the position especially for me, but I was very grateful to them for allowing me to come as both a scientist and as a humanist.
Did you or find more satisfaction from the science side of your professional life and work, or the writing side, or is it a really nice meld?
It's a nice meld. It's like having two children and saying which one do you love more.
always a question you don't want to answer. Mm-hmm. So let's explore your latest book, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. The New York Times Book Review described it correctly as an elegant and moving series of essays about, quote, our spiritual quest for meaning in an age of science. I read it on an island in Maine quite recently, a much bigger one, Mount Desert Island, where Bar Harbor and Acadia is. But I was blown away totally by that book. And to give our audience a sense of why I had that impression and why the critics have loved it, we'd like you to do a brief reading from that comes from the beginning of the book, sort of to set the stage for this discussion.
Okay. I lay down in the boat and looked up. A very dark sky seen from the ocean is a mystical experience. After a few minutes, my world had dissolved into that star-littered sky. The boat disappeared, my body disappeared, and I found myself falling into infinity. A feeling came over me I'd not experienced before. Perhaps a sensation experienced by the ancients at Font de Gomme. I felt an overwhelming connection to the stars as if I were part of them. And the vast expanse of time extending from the far distant past long before I was born and then into the far distant future long after I will die seemed compressed to a dot. I felt connected not only to the stars but to all of nature and to the entire cosmos. I felt emerging with something far larger than myself, a grand and eternal unity, a hint of something absolute.
So you had made that passage many times, and just for our audience, if they haven't read the book, you summer on an island in Casco Bay, off the coast of Maine, and you've been there many, many times for many years, and so you'd made that passage many times. What happened that night?
Well, I don't know what happened. It was after midnight, and I was alone on the water, and I'm not sure what happened. I've had that experience other times. That was not the only time I've ever had that experience, but that's what I described in the book. And you can call it the transcendent experience or whatever, but I think a lot of people have had similar experiences.
Is that the kind of experience that somebody could will, meaning seek and ask for, or is it something that happens?
I don't think that you can seek it, just like you can't seek really creative ideas, but I think you can be open to it.
Let's see. I want to ask just a really mundane question. Why did you turn off your engine and cut your running lights? Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily a safe thing to do.
No,
in open water.
No, it's not a safe thing to do. But I felt like something was special happening, and that I wanted to have complete silence and darkness around me, and as I communed with the sky. No, it was not a safe thing to do.
So we're going to get into the book in a moment, but you mentioned that this was not the first time that this happened, and I'm guessing you refer to at least another such a transcendent moment when years and years ago, early on a Sunday morning, a theoretical problem on your mind, you wrote, "My head was lifting off my shoulders. I felt weightless. I was floating. I had no sense of myself, where I was or who I was. I did have a sense of rightness." Mm-hmm. What happened there?
Well, I've been working on this science problem for 6 months or so and getting nowhere and stuck. And then for some reason, my subconscious mind must have been working on the problem. Came to an understanding that I had not been able to by objectively going from one equation to the next. I think what's common in the transcendent experience, and that was also one, is that we feel connected to something larger than ourselves. And that feeling may or may not involve God or any divine beings, but it's that feeling of connection to something larger than ourselves that I associate with this thing I'm trying to describe, which is so hard to articulate. I mean, you can't objectify it. You can't reduce it to numbers. It's hard to talk about, but you can see it in the paintings and in the caves of Fontagamme. You can hear it in Beethoven's Eroica. It's part of the long stream of feeling and emotion in human beings, this feeling of connection that we've tried to express for thousands of years.
So you've described yourself as a spiritual atheist. What does that mean?
Well, I'm not quite an atheist. I'm somewhere between an agnostic and an atheist.
Okay.
I think, like Einstein, that the problem of God is too vast for our limited minds. That's what Einstein said. But I tend in that direction. But I consider myself spiritual because I have experiences like the kind that I had lying down in the boat looking up at the stars in Maine. And I'm open to those experiences.
How do you reconcile that with particularly your background in the sciences, your subjective, data-driven, empirically produced wisdom, all right, or knowledge? How do you reconcile those two aspects of your being?
Well, the way I reconcile them is I distinguish between the physical world and the spiritual world. And the physical world is the province of science. So any statements about the physical world, including even the creation of the universe, of our universe, because we think there are many universes, whether those statements are in the sacred books or anywhere else, I think if they're statements about the physical world, they have to be examined by the methods of science and rejected if found to be false. But I think there's this other world which is represented by the transcendent experience, which is completely different. I think the question is, God is viewed by most religions as a being that lives outside of the physical world.
Right.
And so, therefore, science can neither prove nor disprove the existence of God. And likewise, religion cannot prove or disprove the existence of God.
And it seems so. So in that framework, miracles are this external being, entity, who would intervene in the physical world. And that is not compatible with science.
That, absolutely, yeah. Intervention in the physical world, which is held in the traditions of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, that's strictly incompatible. But there are other views of God, such as in deism and transcendentalism, pantheism, where God does not intervene in the physical world to perform miracles. And that's perfectly compatible with science.
So historically, there has been a conflict between the material and immaterial, between science and mm-hmm. religion or spirituality. Mm-hmm. And that's really one of the grand themes of searching for stars. Can you talk a little bit about that theme and how you did it over X number of pages in this remarkable work?
Well, the book is for me, is like an extended meditation as I wander about the island in Maine. It's not scholarly, it's not academic. I'm struggling with these issues. That is, how do you balance the material world with the immaterial world? So it as a meditation, it sort of has the feeling of Walden's Thoreau or Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. I don't come to any conclusions. I mean, I think these are, you know, the most profound problems are those that don't have answers. And but I'm turning this over and over in my mind. How can I be a scientist and committed to a material world and also a spiritual person who feels this connection to something larger than myself? So I just turn that issue over and over and look at it in various ways.
Are you still turning this over in your mind?
Yeah.
I mean, do you think you'll ever come to a conclusion?
I won't, no.
You won't?
I don't believe that I will.
Would you like to?
That's a good question. I think there's some questions that I would not like to know the answer to, and this may be one of them. I think that the process of reflection and consideration of the issue is a worthwhile activity on its own.
So other than this remarkable book, how did this transcendent experience floating in the sea at night, has it changed you? Has it affected you in some tangible way?
Well, I think I've had a number of experiences like this one, and I imagine that a lot of our listeners have had experiences like this as well. And for me, the transcendent experience is part of being in the world, but the important thing is being open to it, of sort of it's connected with mindfulness of being in the present, of being open, of letting your mind be open and experiencing things around you. I think that our very high speed life that we live now and being connected to the grid 24/7 discourages this kind of openness, where we don't cut up our day into 15-minute units of efficiency and just are always rushing from A to B, and we don't allow ourselves time for reflection and connection. So I think that our modern lifestyle does discourage this kind of openness.
A neuroscientist might say that the transcendent experience is simply activity in the brain.
Yes.
The neurons, the connections between the neurons.
Yes.
And nothing more. Would you agree with that?
Well, I believe that the brain is all material. I'm a materialist. And so I believe that since our thoughts originate in the brain, that our thoughts are ultimately rooted in the chemical and electrical impulses between neurons. But that does not diminish the experience at all for me. I think that, you know, that 100 billion neurons that we have up there and those 3 pounds of mush are still capable of imagination, creativity, art. So to say that the mind equals the brain and the brain equals the 100 billion neurons, to me, does not diminish the feelings of connection. When I look at Rembrandt's self-portrait at age 53, the fact that came from his hand, which came from his brain, which came from those 100 billion neurons, that doesn't reduce the majesty of that painting or the feeling that I have when I look at it.
I want to ask a question that I don't know that this is the right question, but I'm going to try anyways. We met 30 minutes ago.
Right.
But it seems like you have a level of comfort and maybe awe and wonder with mystery.
Mm-hmm.
The mysteries of the universe, the cosmos, life. Is that a fair...
Yes. Mystery is a very important driver of human creativity. One of my favorite quotes from Einstein is he said that the most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion that lies at the cradle of true art and true science. And he grouped science and art, and he could have added in the humanities, together there as being driven by a sense of mystery.
And Jim's question goes very much to the question I'm going to pose now. One of the grand themes, again, of the book is the question that you pose. What caused the universe to come into being? Why is this something rather than nothing? Those are profound mm-hmm. and very important questions, mm-hmm. certainly for a scientist and for a non-scientist. And you conclude, we don't know and will almost certainly never know
mm-hmm.
a mystery, and you're comfortable with that. Some people would say, wow, that's really disappointing. We'll never know.
Well, we might. We'll never be able to prove it to in the way that a physicist can calculate how many seconds it will take a ball to drop to the floor when dropped from a height of 2 meters. We'll never be able to prove it. But we do have very plausible theories in physics of how the universe, our universe, came into being. And I say our universe because we think that there are many universes. We have theories of how you can create a universe out of a fluctuation in the quantum background of space and time. But the question of why is there something rather than nothing is at a deeper level than how did our particular universe come into being. Why is there anything at all? Why are there laws of physics? And that's a question that I think is deeper than any of the other questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? And that we have no theory for, and of course, not to mention no ability to test anything like that. So that's a deep philosophical and theological question.
Doesn't the concept, though, of a final theory address what we're talking about here? And again, for our audience who may not have read the book, what is the concept of final theory?
Well, all of the theories that we have now, even those that are very accurate, are considered to be provisional. They're considered to be approximations to deeper theories.
We're talking about theories about the universe.
Theories about the universe. Yeah. You know, Newton's theory of gravity worked very well for a couple of centuries, and then it was found that it didn't quite accurately predict the orbit of planet Mercury, and then Einstein's theory replaced Newton's theory, a more accurate theory, and we know that Einstein's theory is probably going to be replaced because it doesn't include quantum. And this is the way science works. But the, so it's always a process of revising. Now, the approximations get better and better. Approximations are good enough to make smartphones and antibiotics, but we don't think that they're exact. Some physicists believe that there is a final theory of nature that would need no further approximation, that it would be exact. And the irony of that is that we would never know if we had it, because whatever theory you have, you can't be sure that tomorrow there might not be an experiment that contradicts the theory. So that's a wonderful irony. So there might be a final theory, but we don't know.
And are there physicists who are working on devising a final
theory? There are physicists who are working on a final theory.
Wow.
Some good physicists.
So this isn't just tilting at windmills.
No,
this is
no. String theory is one of the most prominent proposals for a final theory. This is string theory is a theory that says that the smallest elements of matter are not tiny little particles like electrons, but very, very tiny one-dimensional strings of energy that vibrate. And they're also, according to string theory, instead of having three spatial dimensions, length, width, and breadth, we have about 10 or 12 spatial dimensions that we can't see because they're curled up in ultra-tiny loops. So it sounds pretty wild, but that's our hope right now for a final theory.
So have these transcendent experiences of yours affected you as a scientist?
No, but they have affected me as a human being. And my the part of me that is a scientist, that thinks rationally, that this quantitative, is only one part of me. And there's another part of me that is that takes more qualitative, that just sort of takes experiences as they come.
You have more than one passage in your book where you talk about, for lack of a better word, communing with nature mm-hmm. on your island, mm-hmm. where you lie on a moss-covered hill, where you look at ants with a magnifying glass and see what's going on in that one little tiny area, and there are other such. And I'm paraphrasing now, but you make the point that the particles that compose you, and pardon the non-scientific term particle, were present at the Big Bang, have been around forever. Mm-hmm. And when you pass, when your physical body goes, they will return.
They weren't present at the Big Bang. They were made in stars long ago. At the Big Bang, only hydrogen, the lightest particle, was present.
But these particles are ancient.
They're ancient. They're, you know, billion.
You speaking now, what is comprising your body is ancient material.
Right, it's ancient material. And when I die, the special arrangement of those atoms in my body that make organs and consciousness and neurons, they will disassemble, but they will remain somewhere. Some of them will get dissolved in the ocean, some of them will float in the air, some of them will be dissolved in animals and plants. But 1,000 years from now, my atoms will still be here. I mean, if I could label each one of them with my social security number and follow it, you could follow every single one of my atoms for the next 1,000 years. And the remarkable thing, and this connects to my sense of spirituality, is that some of those atoms will become parts of other people.
Wow.
It's remarkable. We've only got about 45 seconds left. I know that you're involved with the Harpswell Foundation. Tell us what that is.
Well, the Harpswell Foundation is a nonprofit that I started about 15 years ago, and it works to advance leadership in women in Southeast Asia. So we provide dormitories, we provide educational opportunities, we give classes in critical thinking and leadership, and we have a network in which all of our students and young professional women can keep in touch with each other.
And that was named for Hopsville, Maine?
It was named for Hopsville, Maine.
See, I could be a scientist. Well, maybe not.
Good deduction, Watson.
Thank you.
Alan Lightman, the book is Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. Thank you so much for being with us this week. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit PellCenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.